Hey, what? You're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello, it's me, Lackey, broadcasting from the Satellite 11 geostationary orbit around the planet. I've been kidnapped by mad scientists and forced to watch cheesy episodes of occult science fiction television series. As always, I am joined here by the bots to my Joel, or the mic to my Joel, or maybe even the Noah to my Joel. But it's Elwood, and this is TV Good, Sleep Bad. Hey, Elwood.
Hey, Lucky. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, other than the fact that I'm here in outer space.
I know. It's only taken 8 episodes, and we've graduated from the basement to outer space. The budget's increasing slowly.
Very, very, very slowly. Also joining us is our very special guest, Mr. Brian Hines, the last angry geek. Hi, Brian.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here. I'm contacting you from Deep 15, which is 2 better than Deep 13, but it's about 5 miles beneath the Earth's crust. So we've got a real kind of geometry thing happening here as we have to figure out, you know, which point is equal to which angle, et cetera, you know.
Yeah. And they said these things.
It sounded funny in my head.
They said these things would never come in handy in real life when we took these subjects in high school, and guess what? They still aren't. As you may have guessed, we've got a little bit of a MST3K vibe going on with this episode. This is our 8th episode, and we are going to be covering an episode from an experiment from the 4th season of Mystery Science Theater from 1992. It's the 1959 Warner Brothers cheapy Teenagers from Outer Space. And just like every good Chianti deserves to be served with a side of fava beans and a human liver, we have paired up Teenagers from Outer Space with an episode of the original gigantic guy flying around defeating monsters series, Ultraman, from 1966. We have the 10th episode of the original series entitled The Mysterious Dinosaur Base.
After we did Japanese Spider-Man last week, I felt it was only fitting that we look at one of the key figures of these sort of shows. So we're going to look at Ultraman this week, which I'm really excited about, especially because whenever we look at one of these shows, that is normally myself who's overjoyed and everyone else is just confused as to what the hell is going on. So it'd be interesting to see if it's still the same this week.
I think you can enjoy it and be horrified.
I think so. I think there's, you know, again, I'm the guy, as I like to point out roughly every time I open my mouth, I am the guy who did nothing but watch 2 horror movies a week for like 4 straight years. So I know how to be entertained, horrified, and entertained in equal measure.
Well, let me put it this way. There's a reason Evel Knievel was so popular. And it wasn't when he landed properly. You know, you were kind of rooting for him to crash.
That's right. Evel Knievel, ladies and gentlemen, the man we wanted to die for our entertainment. But before we get on to our discussion of our feature episodes, it's time to talk about what have we been watching lately. So I open the question up to you, Brian. What have you been watching lately?
Well, we just wrapped up the last season of The Venture Brothers, which is probably the only show on Cartoon Network or even Adult Swim that I still watch. But and this was a departure from previous years. They got rid of some of their supporting cast. They brought in some new members, and they moved everyone to New York. And it's just kind of a pleasure to see how Doc Rusty Venture is going to screw up his new successful business that he inherited from his late brother. As usual, a lot of the stories were good. This harkened back to a problem they had with season 2 in that the Venture Brothers weren't actually in it all that much. Dean and Hank just didn't have that much to do this season. And the season finale wasn't really much of a finale episode. I think they might have run out of budget a little earlier than they realized and had to wrap it up on the episode they were working on, because it didn't really feel like a this is the end of the season kind of moment. It's just like, here's the adventure, it's over, we'll see in a few years when we get the next season done. But it's still a great cartoon that I love watching, and it has so many, you know, sci-fi pop references in it.
How long has it been running again?
Oh, God. You know, I think it's been going on over 10 years now, and they've only just done, like, season 6 or 7. Because it's just these two guys running the show, and it takes them, like, a couple of years to get a season done.
Right.
It's Doc Hammer and Jackson Public. It's like the craft beer of cartoons.
Uh-huh.
It's done in small batches.
Yeah, like the Louis C.K. of cartoons.
It's the Dark Lord Day of cartoons.
Yeah. They have to let it sit and brew for a while, and they take as long as they want, and Cartoon Network lets them take as long as they want. I have never really watched Venture Brothers all that much. I've seen a couple episodes here and there, but never, I don't know, it never really kind of grabbed me as the sort of thing I had to, like, sit down and watch.
It starts out very kind of taking off on the Johnny Venture, not Johnny Venture, the Johnny Quest cartoon.
Uh-huh.
It really grows in the second and third seasons, especially. I mean, it covers so many, genres. And like I said, there's so much pop culture reference in there. It's just brilliant. I mean, for the longest time, David Bowie was a supporting character on the show.
Nice.
not the actual musician, but they had a character, you know, and they, even on his first appearance, they said celebrity voice impersonated. He was a character in the show for a while.
Cool.
I'm going to loan you season one next time I see you.
All right.
I'm always surprised where David Bowie shows up. I mean, he shows up at the end of Band Slam.
Which... I mean, come to think of it, in the first season, there's an entire episode based around the Bowie song Space Oddity.
Nice.
When Major Tom comes back to life as a zombie.
Okay. But is it better than the Flight of the Conchords adaptation of Space Odyssey?
That I could not say.
Oh, God, yeah. I absolutely love the Flight of the Conchords. Actually, I've only heard the song. I don't think I've actually seen the episode, but I know the song.
Yeah. I think a lot of people seem to think it's like a comedy album. They forget that it's an actual show as well.
Right.
Because the songs are that good that a lot of people sort of have had the album passed to them. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, this song's really great. And they hear things like Ladies of the World or the Hip Hop Optimus and those sorts of things. They think, oh, this is just like these like Kiwis, and they're off doing like these humorous songs. They forget there's an actual show that goes with it, which is really surreal, to say the least. And I think that may be the other reason why a lot of people just tend to stick to the album. But as for Venture Brothers, I've yet to see it. And I'm one of these people that, unless I see it like from episode one, I feel really strange joining a show on like season 3, which is what they've decided to start with over here in the UK on Comedy Central. It's sort of like, oh, we've not shown the previous two seasons, so enjoy season 3.
Yeah, you should definitely. It's worth watching. I own all the DVD sets myself. I mean, it's, you know, I don't do that with many shows, but Venture Brothers is one of them. I like to just pop in and watch every once in a while. I will say also, just as a means of introduction, I'm a video reviewer, and I do video reviews of Doctor Who and comic books primarily. So the other TV shows I'm watching right now are pretty much all like the comic book-based ones, like The Flash, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, Gotham. I'm watching Arrow, but I'm a season behind on that, and I have not watched Supergirl.
Okay. We obviously have to ask, now you mentioned Gotham, because it seems like we can't go a show without talking about either Rick and Morty or Gotham. What's your current feelings on Gotham at the moment? Because I'm absolutely adoring it.
It's much improved over season one. I think they finally got rid of the Smallville Monster of the Week thing that they were doing early on with, you know, every week Gordon would fight another psycho, and they're working more towards longer stories now.
Yeah.
I will say, I think Robin Lord Taylor has given us the best version of the Penguin I've ever seen.
Oh, he's been absolutely phenomenal.
He's the scene stealer on that show, and it's been a good month for Pee Wee Herman. I didn't think I'd ever say that out loud, but you know, he had the new movie on Netflix, which I really liked, and then he had this really good 2-part performance on Gotham as the Penguin's dad, reprising the role he had in Batman Returns, which was just essentially a cameo.
Yeah,
but he really played him as kind of a solemn, thoughtful character, and I really thought it was. I mean, who knew he could act? I thought it was just like this. You know, but no, he can act. It was really good.
I met him at when I was working at Birmingham Airport, and this was during the time when he was like still out in the wilderness. He hadn't really got any of his comeback shows on like Netflix and that. And I remember speaking to him, and he was still like, "Are you Pee Wee Herman?" He was like, "Yes, I am." And he's like, "And it's like, oh wow, what are you watching?" He's like, "Oh, I'm heading out to WrestleMania." I was like, thinking, "Yeah, you're heading out to WrestleMania. What are you doing at WrestleMania?" And then of course WrestleMania comes around, and there's Pee Wee Herman.
And yeah, like, well, he hosted Raw earlier that year. So.
It's like flicking a switch. Like, you see him in normal life, and he's there. He's not shaven, and, you know, he's just some average Joe.
Right.
And then you see him as Pee Wee Herman, and it's like a completely different guy.
Right.
The fact he's now given us this third side to him as a serious actor of sorts, because obviously he's Penguin's father.
Previously, I mean, before that, we'd seen him do, like, comedic acting here and there, like the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. I had a very good recurring role on Murphy Brown in the late 80s, early 90s.
I always remember him from Mystery Men.
Yeah. The colon, the stand, I forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The spleen.
He's a pretty decent comedic actor, but like I said, here he was doing real drama, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Because we've obviously gone from being Rise of the Villains at the first half of the season, and now it's Wrath of the Villains.
Right.
Which I don't understand why they've decided to change the name partway through the season.
They had the Christmas break and they had to take, you know, come back. And
yeah. And the Penguin and the Riddler sharing a flat has probably got to be like, it's a sitcom needing to be written. It's like The Odd Couple with both of them as psychotic.
With knives.
I would pay to see. I would actually pay to see The Odd Couple with them. Maybe I should start watching Gotham now.
God, it's.
I wasn't too crazy about the whole Mr. Freeze thing. Okay. But who I'm really, another guy I'm really impressed by is B.D. Wong playing
Hugo Strange, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's.
It's like the evil version of his character from Law and Order SVU.
But B.D. Wong is now cornering the market in playing evil doctors and psychiatrists, because before this, we had him playing the evil doctor in Jurassic World.
Which he played, that he was the only one back from Jurassic Park. He had like
Now he's playing Hugo Strange, which, am I right in saying in the comic books he's a white guy? And now,
yeah, he's a honky.
Honky
is an American term made famous on a show called The Jeffersons to refer to white people.
Here we obviously have the Asian version, and it works perfectly well. It's like so many things Gotham's done where they've changed characters to fit within this sort of Sin City-esque world that they're crafting.
Right.
And it all works. And the other guy I've really enjoyed, and I mentioned this in our previous show, is the introduction of Michael Chiklis as the commissioner.
The commish!
Oh, he's just God, kicking right. more yeah. and more ass every week.
Well, he played a character called... He had a show called The Commish in, like, the 90s.
Okay.
So that's why everyone's like, oh, it's the... You know, now everyone's going, it's the thing. It's he's playing a police commissioner again. He's the commish again.
But,
No, he's very good. They've had a lot of good actors on that show.
If anyone who has been on our Facebook page, you can find it, TV Good Sleep Bad. You also see that I recently posted the elevator fight sequence, which I think has been the highlight of season two. That's in Gordon's... ex-fiance or girlfriend showing up now crazy in a wedding dress and brandishing a sawn-off shotgun. These have been like the highlights of the season so far. If this doesn't intrigue you enough to watch it, then I don't know what will. Because
it is kind of hard for me to watch Gotham and see his girlfriend is this caring doctor after I've seen her in Deadpool.
Oh, is that Marina Baccarin?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
She's playing his current girlfriend. On Gordon's current girlfriend on Gotham.
Awesome.
I just keep waiting for him to open a present from her and then just look up and she just whispers, "Happy International Women's Day." You don't see what's in the box.
Anything else you've been watching you want to discuss, Brian?
I think I'm covered on everything I'm watching right now.
Elwood.
As always, it's just been a stack of stuff to get through. Obviously, last weekend we had WrestleMania. Don't know if any of you guys watch wrestling.
Yes. I was a ring announcer for an indie fed here in Illinois for about 9 years.
That's a story in itself. I mean, let's not talk about this. Let's talk about that instead.
My friend David's brother, Paul, was a manager in the independent wrestling scene. And through him, I got this gig for Pro Championship Wrestling. They've since shut down a few years ago, but they had a long run, like maybe 12, 13 years in Illinois, and we brought in a lot of guests every year. We would do the show called Dream Night in June, and we would bring in, you know, a lot of famous people, and there were some decisions I didn't like. Like, yeah. In the first couple of years, we brought the wrestlers in to wrestle, but then it became more profitable just to bring them in to do autograph signings, you know, talk to the crowd and go sign things. And I kind of missed, you know, having the wrestlers show up to actually wrestle, but it was a profit thing to help, you know, if a successful Dream Night got us through the rest of the year. So yeah. I understand why they did it. It wasn't how I wanted to run the company, but I was also on booking for about a couple years until I left. So I got to help decide, you know, storylines and who got what and deal with backstage politics that exist even in the indie scene. Even when you're going home with maybe $30 in your wallet, you're still going to fight for your spot and screw people over for power, you know, for in front of a crowd of 50 people. You know, I mean, it was insane. The Illinois feds. I mean, it was a microcosm of what I assume WWE must be like.
Well, WWE have once again gone all out for the WrestleMania weekend. We obviously opened with NXT Dallas. Again, another standout show for NXT, and also saw the introduction of Shinsuke Nakamura, the King of
Street. Oh, that was amazing match.
We also got to see Samoa Joe versus Finn Balor. Finn Balor coming out with a chainsaw because he's pretty much run out of ideas of things to come out as, having like come out as Jack the Ripper. He's come out in a coffin. He's been working the demon sort of angle. So
he was Leatherface this time.
Yeah, he was Leatherface this time.
Texas Chainsaw, you know.
And in about 5 minutes of the match, he managed to bust open Samoa Joe, so there was constant stoppage for blood. And Samoa Joe, who's like a 300-pound Samoan, looked like he was just going to punch the doctor out, which was just incredibly amusing. And the fans are saying, fuck PG.
Yeah.
So it was a phenomenal show, and we obviously had the Hall of Fame the night after, Sting retiring now from professional wrestling, which I'm...
Oh, God, he's been in it for...
decades.
Well, these
decades, really.
Yeah, these last match he had, he took a splash pretty much wrongly on the turnbuckle, and it looked like he wasn't going to walk again for a short period. So basically, I think he took it as a warning sign. It's like you're only going to get so many lucky breaks before you do something really bad. And you see a lot of these older guys, and they're with like canes or in chairs, they can't walk. So if you can get out of your career, like if you with boxing, if you can get out with most of your faculties intact, then you're doing all right for yourself. And, you know, he had a great final match, and I think no one's really going to question him retiring. And if he obviously comes back and does something like Ric Flair does, I don't think it's going to go amiss. But obviously WrestleMania this year, it was a mixed bag. I know a lot of people have been crapping on it and saying it's not been good as the previous 2 years, but...
I like the Intercontinental ladder match. I liked the women's match. That was about it. Let me just briefly go back to the Hall of Fame and say, in the course of my indie career, at one point I got to meet what the late Buddy Roberts of the Fabulous Freebirds. His son was working the independent scene, and I believe we had Ricky Steamboat's son on our show, and so he was in the audience for that with his son and wife. And he had the throat cancer at that time. He couldn't talk, but he could mouth words, and I briefly just got to talk to him, and he was just such a polite, nice man. So I think that was his son on stage accepting the award along with P.S. Hayes and the other guys. So
I have to say, it made me super sad to see Tatanka still trying to wrestle. It's like, just give it up already.
He sounded terrible, super.
He's just a fat white guy dressed as an Indian, and it's just it's so dated, and it's just so sad to see him trying to claw into those golden days. And it was like when Shaq came out this year.
I missed that. I had to go use the bathroom, so I missed Shaq.
Oh, yeah. Shaq came out, and they're setting him up to fight Big Show at next year's WrestleMania, which I'm sure no one's going to be bothered about.
And Big Show will lose, as he always does.
Probably.
Because he always puts the celebrity over.
He's just a company man, though, Big Show is at this point. He's just...
Just write me the check. I've had people say I look like the Big Show.
Really?
Back when I had my beard, especially, I heard that all the time.
That's cool. That's cool.
But I think I look like, if you look at my eyebrows, I look like Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, you do have the Colbert thing going on with your brows.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just trying to remember if there's anything else in the cut. I mean, obviously the women's match, apart from the ending, and now we've replaced
Flair.
Yeah, we've replaced the stupid butterfly belt with a proper women's title now, finally. So, it's nice to see some changes slowly coming in, and I think it's Triple H's influence, because obviously he's on NXT.
I got the NXT Blu-ray that came out.
Okay.
And it's fabulous, with the exception that they kind of screwed over the tag teams. There aren't really many tag team matches in there.
Yeah.
But one of the things they talk about, the rebirth of women's wrestling, in one of the, you know, talking head segments. And they literally cut to it. Once they start talking about how bad wrestling used to be, they literally cut to a shot of Stacy Keibler. Like, ouch. And then, like, the, you know, the mud wrestling matches, the laundry pillow fights, that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah. I think the worst thing to happen with women's wrestling at the moment is the fact that Eva Marie still has a job.
Yeah, they were surprised that she got booed. I'm like, where have you been the last 5 years? We hate her.
Yeah.
Spent 3 years on a reality show and then just recently started wrestling. That said, I thought the match, she had a decent match with Bayley on NXT. Where they kind of played up the idea of her as the corporate champion, the one the powers that be wanted to have the belt. I like that story.
Yeah. Bayley, or as she's now being known, she was pretty much branded the female John Cena by the guys over at the Virtual Pros podcast. I think if she comes up to the main roster, I think that's what she's going to do. I love Bayley. I think she's one of my favorite, the Four Horsewomen. And I just hope they don't screw up when she comes to main roster.
No, just I want to see Bayley Sasha on WrestleMania some year. Those matches were amazing.
Yeah, the other one obviously being Asuka. Asuka's still looking strong. If they can keep finding decent people for Asuka to face, I mean, I don't know if she's going to do anything with Bayley again, but...
Well, they might do the rematch.
Yeah, and the last one I want to obviously mention about would be Undertaker versus Shane McMahon. Shane McMahon decided to throw himself off the top of Hell in a Cell for a table, which, seeing as Shane McMahon's not technically a real wrestler, for him to take such a big bump, I mean, how high is the cage?
About 20 feet.
So to see him do, it was a controlled fall, true. It's not like...
there was an airbag under that table.
The fact is, it's still fucking bloody high when you look at it.
I was at a pay-per-view many, many years ago called Backlash, where he had a hardcore match against the Big Show, and he jumped off the Titantron.
Yeah.
He jumped off on the other side of the Titantron from where I was, so I didn't get to see it, except in the replays. Because I was really like on the, I was as far over to the side as you could go in the cheap seats, and he climbed up on the other side, so I couldn't see him. So, the move everyone was talking about, and I missed it.
Yeah.
I mean, anything else we want to talk about WrestleMania before we?
Just that I like how everything went out the door on Raw.
Okay.
I said I wouldn't give Shane Raw if he lost the match, but what the hell? You can have Raw
for a match.
Yeah, that's good booking, Vince. Thank you.
What
the fuck was the point of putting him in the match with The Undertaker if you're going to give him what he wanted after he lost?
I think because Undertaker's quit now. From what I hear, he's done, but we'll see what happens next year when he shows up.
I've been hearing that rumor for years.
I don't even pay much attention to wrestling, and I've heard that rumor.
Yeah.
He's got a man. He shows up, wrestles once a year, and gets a big fat paycheck.
I think this is the thing. WrestleMania, like the Wrestle Kingdom show, is sort of like the one show that, like, the people don't watch wrestling the rest of the year, they're sort of tuned in for. And it's Lucha Underground, when they do their finale show again this year, is going to be another of those shows where even like people who don't watch show the rest of the year are going to tune in for that one show.
I've been hearing good things about Lucha. I'd like to watch it, but I don't think I get El Rey out here.
Lucha Underground's really great. It's more storyline-based, so it's like you're watching a TV show with wrestling. So it's really worth watching. It really sort of shakes up the format.
I've often said that wrestling is just soap operas for guys.
Obviously, outside of the wrestling, I mean, that's obviously been a major thing, what with WrestleMania weekend. We saw the return of Last Man on Earth. Lucky, I know you tried watching this. Are you still been with it?
I watched, I think, about the first episode and a half.
Okay.
Or at least, if I recall correctly, it was like a double-length premiere. And I think I made about three quarters of the way through that. And I enjoyed what I was seeing. I thought it was a really good performance, particularly a really good performance by Will Forte. And I think I ended up having to turn it off. Something got distracted. I had to turn it off right after they introduced, was it Kristen Schaal's character?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to turn it up right after that. And I thought it had I thought it looked very promising, but I never got back to it, which happens a lot with me.
Okay. Yeah, it's I'm sorry, Brian, have you been watching this
one? I think I got a little further than that, but these are hard characters to spend 30 minutes a week with.
It takes a few episodes to get going and establish things, but I'm still enjoying it. I mean, we're obviously now in season two. It's slowly becoming apparent he's not the last person on Earth. The episode that we just recently had, him and Kristen and Shaw's character, they're trying to repopulate the Earth, and he's found out that he's sterile from the amount of times he was playing this game where him and his brother used to punch each other in the nuts. So essentially, because of that, humanity is going to die because they can't repopulate at the moment. But it's constantly surprising. It's doing some interesting things, unlike The Walking Dead, which finished this week. Walking Dead, obviously, we got to finally meet Negan.
Negan?
I keep hearing different pronunciations.
Spelled N-E-G-A-N.
The actual TV version of him, I have to say, is absolutely spot on.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, right?
It is. He's embodied this character. I mean, when we were talking about this, like, a couple of episodes back, we were saying that he's, like, gonna nail this, and he just knocks it out of the park. Of course, the show writers went and basically oversold the ending. So when we finally get the Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo ending, where one of these our main characters is going to die, it's all shot from the point of perspective of the character who dies. So we get to see Negan basically clubbing a cameraman to death. And there's obviously various rumors around the internet at the moment. If it's like the source material, it's going to be Glenn that cops it. I would like to see it'd be Rick, because that would really shake things up, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I just hope it's not like where it came back after the mid-season break, we were promised three key deaths, and we got the death of three very minor characters, so...
Yeah, that's the, I know, like, I haven't been watching The Walking Dead. I know some of the things that, I already knew about Glenn from when it happened in the comic books a couple years ago.
Yeah.
I have heard that the back half of the season that just ended has really moved a lot of people who have stuck with it through the years to really just throw up their hands and say, I'm done with this shit.
But every year they say that, and every year they come back, because we've come too far.
Right.
So, like, I've come too far to turn back. I have to see how this ends.
Right.
Unless the Bryce
Right, we stuck with Boss till the end, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, there are times when, there are times when I actually have thrown up my hands and said, fuck it, I'm done with this, and walked away. I walked away from, I think it was Sons of Anarchy, I think after the fourth season. And I wouldn't, I think it was when Donald Logue was, like, the big bad of the season. And after that, I just threw up, I said, I can't handle this shit anymore. This is just sadism for sadism's sake.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even care about these characters anymore. And just everything that I've learned about how they ended the show and where it went from there, it's like, yeah, every character I still didn't loathe got knocked off, like, the season after I stopped watching. And I can't deal with that crap anymore.
I think, certainly, if we're going to follow the comic books, because obviously we're entering into the all-out war sort of period for Walking Dead, so obviously we're going to end up with Rick's groups over at Alexandria, going to have the big showdown with the Saviors. I think a lot of fans who aren't familiar with the source material are going to be expecting it to just, like, keep knocking up a notch, really. We're going to have the big showdown with Negan, and it's just going to keep going from there. But in the comic books, it basically enters this period of rebuilding of society after
the two most recent trade paperbacks myself. I only ever watched the first season of The Walking Dead. I kind of got mad at them for firing Frank Darabont.
Yeah.
So I never really followed up. But I've been reading the comic book forever, and they do a time skip. They jump ahead like 5 years.
Yeah, and he spends all that time in prison. Which, when I saw in the series they built where you've got the prison being built at Alexandria, I was like, yeah, that's exactly where he's going to end up. We're not going to get the satisfactory death for his character that we obviously got with the governor who got decapitated and then his head was still going, which was pretty cool. So it's, I think a lot of people are going to be, who aren't familiar with the source material, are going to be a little down on the fact that we're going to have this time, we're more than likely going to have this time skip, and it's going to enter into this slow period again of society trying to rebuild itself, and
it's like communes start growing up, like little towns. But what I love about Robert Kirkman in The Walking Dead is every time you think he's gone as far as he can with a villain, he tops himself. Like you think, okay, the zombies, then, oh, God, the governor, that's a monster. And then, oh, God, Negan, he's even worse. And then
yeah.
Wait till Alpha and the Whisperers show up. That's all I'm going to say.
I love the fact that I love reading people who aren't familiar with the source material, and they're like, oh, he's like this biker and stuff. And it's like, no, he's a used car salesman.
Yeah.
Who just realized that by using force that you can basically get people to do what you want. And like, this is going to be the only way to survive in this new world. It's by the order of violence. There's no room for civility in this world.
Right.
Only the strong are going to survive. And those who are willing to take are going to prosper, the same as in when we look at the Mad Max world. It's that same sort of world, it's just a little more green.
Watch out, just watch out for the fucking iron, folks.
Yikes.
That's all I'll say.
The other disappointment in another show, which I still wonder why I'm watching it, is The 100, which has decided after two seasons is going to try and turn itself into Game of Thrones.
Oh, beautiful.
We had two pretty strong seasons, and now we've entered season three. It's like we've suffered a time skip, even though apparently only a couple of months have passed on the actual timeline. But now these characters who didn't know their asshole from their elbow and now like fully adapt, they're all like trained in like riding horses, and they can all speak like the local dialect, and it's just become just a complete mess. And we've got this character Quinn, who suddenly became bisexual for no apparent reason other than probably to boost the ratings, the same way that Buffy did when Willow suddenly became a lesbian witch. And we've got this whole idea where you've got 13 tribes now, and I'm just looking at it, it's going, you saw Game of Thrones was making money and you thought, screw this, we're out of original material, we're just going to turn it into Game of Thrones with like a slightly futuristic setting to it. Again, this is another show I just wonder why I'm watching. I guess I've just got time in the watch schedule at the moment and needed to fill it with something, so it has its fans, but I'm still wondering why the hell I'm still watching.
Most of the people I know who have kept with the 100, I haven't seen it, but most of the people I've been talking to, why they've kept up with it is because of eye candy. It
really?
seems to be the overriding reason that anybody still sticks with this show.
Okay.
It's because they think the actors and actresses are cute.
Yeah. I don't know about yourself and Brian, but when you have a show which is filled with very obviously pretty people, so it looks like a GQ explosion, and this is again the fault with most modern horror, I just lose interest. I need some sense of like normal person. That's why I love Game of Thrones, because not everyone's pretty. You've got some real grimy looking characters, and it's a real mixture of characters.
Just the women. Just the women are pretty on that show.
I don't know, really. All of them?
Oh, yeah.
I suppose you got some variety there, so.
You do. I mean, you've got...
Remember old man? Hello.
How exciting.
You've got Gwendolyn. You've got Gwendolyn Christie on that show. And Gwendolyn Christie is not by any... She's a very, very beautiful woman, but she's not, you know, your standard TV model type by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. So I guess we're all happy that it's almost time for it to come back, so...
Yeah, it's coming back at the end of the it's coming back the end of the month, I think.
Yeah, three months ahead of time, Sky Atlantic decided to start advertising the show. It's got that big a following, and they're basically here in the UK, they're trying to recruit as many people to come back for this new season as possible. So they're really pushing people to watch the box sets ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
They did a recent run of Christmas where they showed every episode, like on consecutive nights. So they're really
because the red wedding is something you really want to watch around Christmas.
Yeah,
you know, that's what we should do for our Christmas special this year. Game of Thrones. There's nothing more festive than the red wedding.
I've got the box sets myself, and there's so much stuff in them. Like I've just barely gotten through season three in the run. I've seen them all as they happen, but then I go back and watch the box sets, and it's like, you know, it's like it takes so long to get through everything on there. They put so much information in there.
Yeah.
HBO's box sets are notorious for being not necessarily, I would say, overpriced, but like twice the twice or three times the price, at least over here in the States, of like any other like box set for like any other like equivalent show. But damn, they load those things with special features and featurettes and all that stuff.
Yeah,
they really they really give you your money's worth with those.
Yeah. I mean, I've no idea where season 6 is going to go. We're obviously adapting material from the forthcoming Winds of Winter. We've also got material from Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. I've never read any of the books, so it's always new whenever I watch this show what's going to happen. But it's still keeping my interest. I'm still enjoying it. It's never seemed to have hit the low that a lot of long-running shows have had. And I think it's just due to the sheer amount of characters that we're following and its ability to switch from one group to the next.
For me, I thought it hit... I think the high water mark of its quality has been the episode The Reigns of Castamere. And I haven't really been as enthusiastic about a lot of the stuff that they've done since then. I've been really, really critical of like how they've handled certain things like the Lannister twins and some of the stuff they did with Sansa last year. But yeah. At least they've kept... you've read the books, right, Brian?
I've made the decision I'm not going to read books until after the series is over.
Okay. Then never mind. I thought you had read the books for some reason. What they did with Sansa last year, I was pretty critical of that, but it's kept me, there's enough interesting stuff going on with all these plot lines that's kept me interested. You know, I don't want to say it's jumped the shark yet, but I don't have the, it doesn't give me the sort of Jones or Frisson that it gave me really in its first three seasons.
I used to review Game of Thrones. That was another one of my shows. I did seasons 2 and season 3, and then I just kind of had to stop because I was putting in a lot of work. I had to do a lot of post-production stuff on that show. But I'm kind of glad I got out when I did, because I don't really know how I could review an episode about a girl being burned alive and make it light and funny for my God, they didn't do that. That said, they ended that episode probably the only way they could, with Danny riding a dragon.
Yeah.
I think for myself, Blackwater has been the true pinnacle for the show. I remember watching the wildfire explosion in particular, which is just like probably the most amazing set piece I've...
Well, there's always that one episode they do in the season where they kind of devote everything to the one story instead of...
Yeah.
Right.
Like you said, the Reigns of Castamere or the Blackwater Bay or... was the one recently with the going to recruit the wildlings and then the White Walkers attack.
Yeah, and that was probably my favorite. Those tend to be my favorite episodes. I remember really, really liking that episode.
Yeah.
But then again, that's probably the whole drama up there between the wildlings and the wall, the Night's Watch. That's probably my favorite plot line.
I used to be, is it Dothraki?
The Dothraki.
I used to really love her storyline, The Mother of Dragons, and you have to excuse me.
That's been one of my favorite stories, is Dany's kind of rise to power, you know.
But this thing, she had this wonderful rise to power, and then she kind of wandered in the desert, and since then, she sort of struggled to get back to where she was, like, in that first season, where you see her go from, like, the naive girl to really embodying her power and her position within the clan. It was a wonderful rise, and then it sort of all fell apart, and while she obviously took on the position, a new position of power, she's never really sort of hit the same heights.
She's growing as a leader, she's becoming a queen, and it goes from just ruling a tribe to taking over a city to kind of ruling these whole lands, you know, it's been that kind of, but still trying to be true to who she is, trying to be, you know, not turn into a monster because of it.
Yeah, and actually that's another one, and mainly because, I mean, I like a lot of the big, you know, big action set pieces on it. But one of the things I really like about Game of Thrones, just the political maneuvering and the whole philosophical questions of, like, leadership and stuff like that. So I know a lot of people have been very, very critical of, for the past couple of years, of where Dany's storyline has gone. I really like it. I really have liked it in the books and in the show. And I've really, really become impressed with Emilia Clarke as an actress, and what she brings to the character and how she pulls that off.
Speaking of, like, the political maneuvering stuff, like, one of my favorite scenes last year was, I can't remember the character's name, but he was the one, Kingsguard, that got sent up to the wall.
Janos Slynt. Janos Slynt. Oh, yeah.
Second in command for the guy who really wants to be in charge.
Right.
I can't remember any names right now, and I apologize.
Alistair Thorne.
Right. And when John is put in charge and he refuses the order, he takes him out to execute him. He starts begging for his life, and he says, I'm afraid. I've always been afraid. And that's when he kills him. I think that's when you have to kill him, because if he's afraid, he's no good to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was such a political moment. Like, you know, any other situation, I'd probably forgive this guy, but he just said he's a coward, and I can't have that here.
I love how they did that. I love how they did that scene. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the books, too. I just love how they pulled it off. I just thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, there's just some really great moments on that show, and I wish, you know, I wish more shows had great moments.
Yeah.
The old Black Mirror.
Sorry, 100.
Yeah, I just love the Black Mirror title screen that Game of Thrones ends on, so you can see that look on your face as to what the hell just happened.
Yeah.
But no, that's myself. Like, what have you been watching them?
Well, as I've been mentioning the last few episodes, we're in the midst of my major TV watching season here with, I think by the time we'd recorded the last episode, I think the X-Files just ended.
Yeah.
American Crime Story, People v. O.J. Simpson, sorry, that just ended, and I was pretty happy with that show overall. I seem to remember, he got off.
Oh, wow!
I was really, really betting against that. I just really thought that, you know, I thought they had it nailed, even though with the glove thing.
Yeah.
I just thought Shapiro was going to bungle at the last minute. But no, I thought they, it was an interesting thing, and a lot of people made some weird casting choices that a lot of people remarked on. Everybody's been talking about the catchphrase for David Schwimmer's character has been Ross Kardashian in the description of his character, because he pretty much plays it just like Ross, but he with Johnny Cochran being the Rachel to his Ross. There have been some questionable things here and there, but I think anchored by some really good performances. Sterling Brown is Chris Darden, Courtney B. Vance is Johnny Cochran, Sarah Paulson is Marcia Clark. I thought they just, all three of them, just really nailed it and anchored, and just really, I've really enjoyed the show. So I know you weren't as impressed with it, Elwood. Did you keep up with it?
I've watched the first episode, and I've been taping it, so it's on the box to watch. I just keep getting distracted by other things, like this show that started on the Crime Investigation Network called 60. They put these civilians in jail for 60 days and don't tell the prisoners that they're actually civilians.
Oh yeah, they've got that. Yeah, the one. That just started over here too. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I've got to mention too. This, but. This has been on my reality TV watch, but basically they put civilians in, and only the three people in the prison know that they're civilians.
Uh-huh.
And there's this teacher in there who's basically pissed everyone off within 10 minutes of going into this block that's known for violent criminals. So now they think that he's a cop, and his only friend in there basically at the end of the first episode got beaten up.
Right, I had heard about that.
I mean, I was going to, it's a 2-hour opening. I was only going to watch like a little bit of it, but myself and my wife, we sat down, we ended up watching all 2 hours of this opening. It was that gripping. So wow. I'm interested to see who gets shanked, who gets out.
Oz the reality show, ladies and gentlemen.
To shank or not to shank? That is the question.
So American Crime Story, second season of Better Call Saul is winding down. I think we got two more episodes to go. This started off, I thought it got a little bit of a shaky start with Jimmy kind of reeling from his brother's betrayal, and then he got a job offer from the firm that HHM are collaborating with on this the corrupt chain of assisted living centers, and he went to work for them for a while and worked for Ed Begley Jr.
Hey.
One of the more interesting casting choices.
He's turned up in interesting places, though. He was in the Amazon show Betas as well.
Oh!
Yeah, he plays a tech investor, and he whenever he shows up, because he's supposed to be like a was he a vegetarian geo guy, but every time he shows up, he's just like sweary and angry, and it's brilliant. Everyone loves an angry vegetarian.
Yeah, well, those are the best kinds. But it about halfway through, it really started to find its rhythm again, I thought, and we got some really good plot lines going now. We've got a couple more characters from Breaking Bad added to the mix, and there is specifically one I think may turn up in the finale. Not to name any names, but let's just say he was a higher up at a fried chicken chain of restaurants. I think he might show up before the season's over.
Oh, Norm McDonald.
Yeah, Norm McDonald.
All right.
No, actually, Jim Gaffigan.
Not Daryl Hammond?
Not Daryl Hammond. Never Daryl Hammond.
Not the flag? I don't know.
Yeah, those commercials have really been... We should just start our own podcast for commercials, now that I think about it. So let's see. So that's winding down. The Americans has started back up. And wow, I don't even want to talk about what's going on in The Americans if nobody's been... I don't want to spoil too much from the end of season three, but damn, they have really, really taken it into some dark territory. And the most recent episode that aired, I think it was episode 4, just aired as we're recording, it was a real sucker punch to the kidneys. Had me genuinely with my mouth gaping open, and just a brilliant, brilliant, I think, every season I get more and more impressed with their casting choices, and they brought, as a new regular on, they've brought Dylan Baker on as a reluctant traitor who has been helping, who has been supplying Frank Langella's character with biological agents to ship over to the Soviet Union. So that's always fun.
And hopefully Dylan Baker always plays reluctant fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
He's reluctant in every part he plays. I don't think I should.
The only exception I think is it was his screen debut, but he plays the one yokel in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. He has my favorite line, the first baby came out sideways line. That's like the only. But yeah, he's always kind of got that kind of shifty-eyed, I don't really want to be doing this, that he just does so damn well. So that started up again, and Bates Motel has started up again.
Still?
Yeah, Bates Motel is still going on. Huh?
He hasn't gone crazy yet? When is he going to start killing people? Come on!
He already has.
Okay, then.
Yeah, he's, well, mother.
Quote, mom's unquote, still alive, or is she in the rocking chair yet?
She's not in the rocking chair yet.
All right.
But that's another one where they've got a great cast. Vera Farmiga is Norma. I always want to call him Eddie Redmayne. He's not Eddie Redmayne. Freddie Highmore as Norman, and of
Charlie
course
for the Chocolate Factory?
Yes! I shit you not. Charlie from the Chocolate Factory.
What did Mr. Wonka do to that boy? Some bad shit went
Johnny,
on.
Johnny Depp, how could you? How could you, Johnny? And of course, the great Nestor Carbonell. So that's been going on. There's been some pretty good stuff there. I'm sure that Elwood will want to mock me because a certain BBC show about midwives in the early 60s has started up again. And I think the second episode's airing tonight. And that's, I think that Call the Midwife, I think that the last series was a little bit shaky. I think
it's
so
the BBC. Of course, it's going to be shaky.
They can't afford a Steadicam, so of course it's going to be shaky. But I think they were lost their way a little bit trying to figure out where to go after the loss of Jessica Raine. But I think the first episode I really liked and had some really good bits in it and really handled a couple of issues. I thought going back to like Trixie's, some of Trixie's problems, like Trixie's alcoholism and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's what's been. Oh, and I pretty much watched the entire run of Archer in about a month. except for the new season. I haven't seen the new season yet, but Archer has been what I've been watching, binge watching for junk food.
I have to ask it. Obviously, with Netflix, the latest Amazon, the latest Netflix exclusive show, Judd Apatow's Love. Did anyone else watch this one?
No.
Okay, just me then.
Probably.
I think whenever they put some shoegaze comedy on there, because it was the same with Masters of Horror. Not Master of Horror, Master of None.
Master of Horror, Aziz Ansari, Topher, yeah, same person when you get right down to it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I really enjoyed Love. I thought it was a fun show. It's more basically what Judd Apatow does, just right. Basically in sitcom format. And yeah, I think it's one of the shows like Girls, which also is back now and just going for the motions, really. Does anyone even care what Lena Dunham has to say about anything?
No.
No.
I never cared to begin with. That's why I never watched Girls.
I think I cared for, like, the first season, and then she decided that, you know what, fuck all you guys who have basically been supporting the show. I'm just going to go and cash in the glamour dollars, and, you know, I'm just going to play this angle and pretend I'm a feminist and just write a bunch of bullshit. And
also, it's Sex in the City.
It's basically, that's what it basically is falling down to. It's this, it's this yuppie vision of New York. And obviously it's getting people like Bret Easton Ellis excited because that's his territory. And I mean, Bret Easton Ellis on his podcast, he thinks that you can watch a show episode one and go to the final episode and then judge the whole series. So,
you mentioned Bret Easton Ellis and now I'm just like,
look, it's people.
Those two kind of work. Dunham and Bret Easton Ellis, I would actually pay to watch anything those two did together.
Oh my god.
That's just like such an entertaining combination.
Are you surprised though? It's hipsters doing drugs and having sex. This is his territory he created, basically,
I know.
I would hate him more if he weren't such an influence.
I tried reading one of his novels once. I think it was Lunar Park, and it's like I walked away. I tried to get through it like five times. I finally made it through it. It's like, wow, you are just so motivated by this sort of narcissistic self-loathing. Yeah. It's he is an amazing human being. He's probably the scum of the earth, but
he's a defender of Eli Roth because he's a sensationalist.
Oh, God.
And it's like, no, just because you gush over your guests and use this fancy little buzzword while commenting about being Empire and post-Empire for about seven shows in a row doesn't make you deep or meaningful or give you reason for any sort of justification for what is garbage, you know? It's shit, still shit, even if you put it under a fancy name.
Christ, it's like he's someone who... He's learned the buzzwords of postmodernism and structuralism, but doesn't actually know what they mean.
But saying that, I mean, if you're going to read his books, you can't start with Lunar Park. Lunar Park's like the tail end of his career. It's like reading the later Chuck Palahniuk books. It's no good.
Yeah.
You've got to read the early stuff. You've got to read Less Than Zero, Rules of Attraction especially, and American Psycho's still got its charms, even though the film was kind of screwed it up because... I don't know. I didn't like the film version because it wasn't enough like the book, and everyone's like raves about the film version, which makes me feel bad about liking the book. So, but no, Chuck Palahniuk, he's still doing interesting things at the moment. I mean, he's basically just experimenting with it, with fiction. I mean, he's trying to make writing interesting for himself. But no, his early books, especially things like Fight Club, Invisible Monsters, Choke, they're all still fantastic books.
Yeah.
And well worth reading.
A friend of mine shoved one of his books into my hand and told me to read it, and I never have.
Okay.
I don't know which one it is. I'm looking at it. It's on my bookshelf right now, but it basically on the spine, it just says Chuck Palahniuk in huge letters, and then in tiny letters I can't read from where I am is the title of the novel. From what I remember, I think it's the one, I think it takes place on an airplane that's about to crash.
Oh, Survivor.
Survivor.
Yeah, Survivor. I think the more we go on, especially in these years of reality TV, it becomes more relevant. The same way that Series 7, The Contenders, when it came out, especially in the UK, its format didn't work because we didn't binge watch TV shows, but now we have, we're now on the format of where we do marathons of reality shows, so it works all the better. Now we're obviously in this era of seeing who's the freakiest person we can get on top of the celebrity freak pile. Because you, I mean, just compare like the real world, like season one to what we have now. So I was going back for my tapes and I found like one of the old seasons. I'm not sure which one it was, but there was some guy from the country speaking to an inner city black guy and they were having a discussion about religion. And then it came up with a trailer for the new season and it's like the transvestite former crack addict arguing out with the pageant queen about God knows what. And you're thinking, oh, how far we've fallen.
Yeah.
But yeah, Survivors, I like it. It's good. It's got some interesting moves and certainly an interesting comment on celebrity, the same way that Haunted is, which is basically him playing a game of one-upmanship as to how disgusting he can be within the concept of a short story collection.
Awesome.
Yeah, has anyone else got anything else they want to talk about?
I do not.
Brian,
I'm good.
Anything at all? You're all good?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's on to our first selection of the evening. Lucky, this was your selection. You chose MST3K. Yeah, MST3K, the episode Teenagers from Outer Space. Why did you choose this?
I wanted to pick an episode of MST3K. I wanted to pick one that I wasn't overly familiar with. And I didn't want to go to one of the obvious ones, like Manos or the Gamera ones or Mitchell.
Anytime you pick a movie at Mystery Science Theater episode with teenagers in the title, you're good.
Yeah. So I looked at a list of like, you know, underrated MST3K episodes and they said Teenagers from Outer Space. So I thought I'd pick this one. Now, I guess, how well is MST3K known outside the United States? He asked Elwood.
Pardon? Here, and it's sort of something that got passed around. I think certainly more in the years of YouTube. To an extent, through when people were tape changing, you would have it come through. It would come through and with things like Captain Video.
Right.
It'd be this obscurity little thing that would come through. And Elvira tapes again. And like these... Because over in the States, you obviously have like the horror hosts and things like that that would introduce the movies, and we never had this sort of show which took like the Peanut Gallery style of viewing. I think the closest we had was a show Craig Charles used to do of Red Dwarf fame, where he would introduce a B movie and he would like go through the different moves and take the piss out of different aspects of it, such as like what he did When Worlds Collide, and he would like judge the impressive rocket launching, but not so impressive launch of the actual rocket itself, where it's just a little model flying off a rail. And he would highlight these little things, and that was the closest we had to Mystery Science Theater over here in the UK. But certainly it has its own little cult following, but it's more through word of mouth and through people looking it up on YouTube, because obviously you guys in the States seemingly talk about it all the time. It seems to have been this big influence, especially for a lot of cult cinema fans and vloggers that use it as like this was the inspiration point for what they obviously do now,
right? Yeah. And
Mystery Science Theater is kind of undergoing a renaissance right now because they just had a very successful Kickstarter to bring the show back.
One of the guys over at Lair the Unwanted is the executive producer now because of how much he donated to that campaign.
Maybe we got 14 episodes back. They were hoping for 3 at least, and they got 12, the full 12, and then they had to add on more because they kept getting more and more donations. And then Riff Tracks, which was run by some of the people who left MST, just had their Kickstarter to fund their live shows this year. And one of the shows they're doing is the MST3K reunion show. So they're going to have everybody back on that riffing shorts live. And I've actually got to work with the Riff Tracks crew, Mike Nelson, Bill Corbett, and Kevin Murphy, because as part of Channel Awesome, we won a contest to get to write and perform a riff for their website. And we did Batman Forever, and it was a lot of fun working with them.
Yes. It's certainly a unique art.
Well, I think it invented an art. I mean, everyone kind of makes, you know, and before, they said everyone was kind of making jokes to their friends in a theater, but they're the ones who kind of made it into a business or profitable.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was this in the years before the twin juggernauts that basically turned Comedy Central into what it is today, in the, you know, South Park and The Daily Show, in the years before those two shows, it was the, I guess, the killer app for Comedy Central. It was, I mean, not that Comedy Central didn't have other good shows on it, but it was like the thing that drew people to the channel. You know, it was the gateway drug. And it was, I remember it at the time, kind of having this sort of vibe that you were that they had basically kind of taken something that just about everybody does and kind of honed it down to a comedic art form.
Yeah.
And it's just, you really do see it in so many different, I mean, you know, not that just, it, not simply just that, you know, after the demise of MST3K, you had Mike Nelson go out and start riff tracks with Bill Corbett and Kevin Murphy. And then on the other hand, you had a lot of the other originals, you know, Joel, Trace Ballou, J. Elvis Weinstein doing Cinematic Titanic.
Right.
And even
there was a long period where they didn't do anything. And that's, Mike credits the internet with making, you know, it possible to start doing like riffing DVDs and stuff to like with the, you could suddenly digitally transmit MP3 tracks and stuff and
right
video on demand. I mean,
because
until the internet caught up with what they wanted to do, there was kind of like a blank period where we had to subsist on our VHS tapes.
Right.
Central.
You know, and now that, because if I remember correctly, Riff Tracks initially basically just started off as essentially podcasts that you would just basically sync up with your own copies of the movie and you'd run them like a commentary track.
Right, exactly. You'd get an MP3 file and you'd run it on your computer or on your MP3 player and watch the movie.
Yeah. And the technology has really kind of caught up to people being able to do that on their own. And, you know, it really has kind of undergone a renaissance and a new era of renewed interest, and to the point where for the revival, they've actually got Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt doing regular roles. They're the new Mads on the revival, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's just, but at the time it was, there was, I remember there was one show that ran, like, it may be in syndication throughout the 80s, that they would basically take, edit down old movies, and they would redub it, you know,
yes,
with these comedy lines. Was that Mad Movies or something
Mad
like
movies
that?
Mad Movies with the L.A. Connection.
Yeah, Mad Movies with the L.A. Connection.
You can find them on YouTube, but they were hilarious. And yeah, as a kid, I watched those on Nick at Night.
Uh-huh. That's
the
where they had them on Nick at Night.
Season, they replayed it for, like, years, but it was hilarious stuff. Like, I think my favorite was, they redubbed Hitchcock's DOA as an episode of I Love Lucy.
Nice.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Richard O'Brien is Desi Arnaz trying to find out Ed and Lucy have run off together and he and Ethel are falling in love. I mean, it's ridiculously fun. And he dies at the end. And what do we say, Chief? We'll just mark it DOA. Dreadfully overacted. I mean, yeah, really funny stuff. I regret that there's no DVD release on those, but they
yeah.
But that was the precursor, definitely, of Mystery Science Theater.
And it just kind of, there was nothing else like it on television at the time. And there really still hasn't been anything quite like that. And it kind of had, the other thing that I think always really kind of drew people to it is it has this sort of sense of, a very distinct sort of sense of humor. And I think probably a lot of stuff, I think probably a lot more of these gags might be more I think since popular culture is kind of seems to be a little bit of a wider thing now, it doesn't seem like, you know, this episode in particular, the Teenagers from Outer Space, there seemed to be a running gag of references to the band B-52s.
Yes, because we get the mention of Planet Claire.
We get the mention of Planet Claire, obviously, and the big monster is a the big monster in the film is of course a lobster, which, you know, which triggers a reference to Rock Lobster.
Right.
And it's like, which person on the writing staff had just listened to that first B-52s album right before? I remember there was one, I think it's in Manos, The Hands of Fate, where I was watching it, and there's this, on the soundtrack, there's this flute solo. And I think it's Kevin Murphy says, can we let Tim Weisberg out now? And I honestly think I'm the only person when I first saw that, born like after 1970 who knew who Tim Weisberg is, yeah. You know?
Well, the famous quote is, with their jokes, not everyone's going to get it, but the right people will get it.
Right.
They tell jokes not for the sake of the easy laugh, but for what they think is funny for the situation, even
right.
if it's the most obscure references ever. My favorite thing about this, I always get sucked up into the movie sometimes more than the jokes. My favorite thing about this was like the skeleton ray gun.
Yes.
Where they shoot people and they instantly turn into a skeleton, and then they kind of pay it off in the host segment where that ship shows up and they're, you know, they do like the Lowe's candy thing and they're talking about it for the rest of the time, and they throw all this candy into space like the old Lowe's Welcome to Our Theater thing.
Yeah.
And then this big spaceship shows up and it's so cool, and they open the hex field, it's just a skeleton, and they're like, yeah, what? And it just shakes and then falls to the ground. It's so lame.
It is a very, and that's what this is a really bloodthirsty film, at least for like the first chunk of it, to kind of go into the plot of the film. It's about aliens who come from outer space, and basically they just want to use it as a breeding ground for their, what are they called?
Gargons.
Gargons.
Which is,
essentially their cattle.
Not remotely like Gorgons. Gargons, you know, which I guess are a delicacy on their planet. Basically they just basically want to use the Earth as a breeding planet and, you know, screw the native inhabitants.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
When
you
haven't once
even said what a gargon essentially is, which
it's a gigantic fucking lobster.
It's not just a lobster; it's a lobster held in front of the camera, and some guy going, "Ah,
yeah."
Well, then there's, and it's the race that's embraced logic over feelings, but then Johnny Rebel has discovered a book with the old ways in it, and he discovers Earth is inhabited, and we must not release the gargons here.
And brothers, sisters, yeah. It's just he gets like religion or a conscience out of nowhere, and his name is Derek. And then the other one, like almost like this, despite the fact that he's all like, you know, supposed to be logical and stuff like that, he's so bloodthirsty, and his name is Thor. And Thor just basically spends about the first half of the film just basically shooting everybody. Who he almost everybody who talks to with this ray gun that turns people into skeletons that just strips all the flesh off their bones.
Yeah,
and because he hates Derek so much.
He hates Derek so much.
And then Derek finds out that he's actually the son of the leader, and you know, it proves that George Lucas wasn't the only one to read Joseph Campbell. Because I mean, Luke finds out that he's the son of Darth Vader. I mean, yeah. Oh, I'm actually the son of the evil emperor. I have all these great ideas, and I'm destined for greatness. And yes, I am.
And he looks like Doctor Strange, the big leader.
He had the beard. I mean, he kind of looked like he was wearing a taped-on beard.
He looked like he was. He looked for some reason every time he showed up.
He looks like Dr. Sarkoff. That's who it is.
Yes. Yes. Actually, the one I kept, yeah, and I kept thinking to myself, Brian Blessed.
Someone from Flash Gordon.
Somebody from Flash Gordon. I kept thinking I kept flashing back to that, the Dead Ringer sketch.
Well, I remember one of the things on Mystery Science, well, I'm sorry, we'll get to that in a second. One of the things on Mystery Science Theater is whenever they had Jack Perkins on, he'd always start going, and then Topol will be on. Topol's who played Dr. Zarkoff in Flash Gordon, so I just got epiphany there. I'm sorry, Dead Ringers,
the recurring sketch about villains, British character actors playing villains. You know, I think it was Ian McKellen squaring off with Alan Rickman, and at the end they both die, and then somebody runs on screen and says, I'm Brian Blessed!
That's all he says. He doesn't bother to do anything else.
And I think it's Culshaw actually. Now I don't know if it's Culshaw or somebody else doing Alan Rickman. I always just love the way he said, "And nobody told Kenneth Branagh where the auditions were." But anyway, we're talking about MST3K.
Yeah. I mean, the leader himself is actually played by an actor called King Moody, which I guess could be like a good name for anyone in this film, because they're so moody. No one's happy in this movie at all.
It's like emo, 60 years early.
I mean, the fact it's called Teenagers from Outer Space and no one's a teenager.
Well, that was a common problem in movies from the 60s.
But, I mean, obviously when it was released in the UK, we had it released as the Gargon Toe, which is probably more appropriate. And during production, it was also known as the Ray Gun Toe, which I think is really great. The poster itself I really want for my office, as it promises thrill-crazed space kids blasting the flesh off humans. Which, you know, is not the sort of thing you get these days. And you even get little...
It doesn't really blast the flesh off. It more disintegrates the flesh.
Yeah. You get a little before and after shot on the bottom of the poster of someone getting shot with a ray and turning into a skeleton. It's the recreation of the go in the swimming pool's death.
Yeah.
I have to say, this is going to be so unusual to riff on because they hit all the key points in this episode. Whenever you see something that you're like, oh, I'm going to riff on that, and it's like, nope, we're going to hit that. And the reoccurring joke about someone being in the trunk of the car. It's like, even in the whenever you think that they hit a low, they just like do something like that and it just like keeps it going. Although for myself, it's only when the giant lobster appears that it sort of really found its groove. Until then, it sort of seemed to be shuffling along, and you'd have like the joke about the grandfather just always sleeping and whatnot. So,
I feel like taking a nap. I haven't slept in 45 minutes. That was actually the thing I liked about the reel-to-reel host segment, where they actually kind of like previewed some of the running jokes that they would debut, that they would introduce later on in the episode. In real life, you have in the film, you have a drunken man sleeping on your couch, and in real life,
real life, a drunken man sleeping on your couch. Yeah.
And all the running jokes about the dog, the dog's bones are always where they left them. And I think there's this one point where they revisit that spot. The dog's bones are still there. And the camera's positioned on the dog, the bones, and someone in the one of them just says, "Arf!" And I just lost it.
better get a baggie and pick up Sparky and get out of here.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's not one of the ones I think I'm going to remember as being one of the it's never, I don't think, going to stand out in my mind as like one of the absolute best examples of MST3K. Yes. But I thought it was fairly solid.
On a tangent here, how we mentioned LA movies, the American version of Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Right.
Used to do a film dub as one of their games. And they did this Teenagers from Outer Space, that scene where they're at the gas station and he blasts people into skeletons. And it was like Ryan Stiles, Kyle Mockery, Greg Proops dubbing the scene. I know it's if you look for those, the film dub segments on YouTube, that'll be there.
Cool. I didn't know that they'd done that.
Yeah. But I'm sure it was one of those, you know, cheapo movies they got access to.
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen many MSKs that, It's obviously got that uniqueness. I struggle with the format because it is basically, it's like going to like a Rocky Horror show with like a proper audience and people just yelling crap at the screen every 5 seconds. And the part of me, obviously being a B movie fan, wants to kind of watch the movie, but these constant peanut gallery comments that we obviously have from is it Joel?
Joel.
And his two robot companions, at times it felt a bit distracting, then other times it like really hit it spot on. As you mentioned, the reel-to-reel segment where they like talk about the landlord, and it's like, in the film version, he'll be like a nice, helpful old man. In the real life, he's going to be some creepy guy going for your panties. And I think the film selection, I don't know, maybe this worked better if it's a better film selection. Like, they've done Squirm, which I didn't really particularly like the normal version, so hopefully that would improve it.
What I always enjoyed about MST is it wasn't afraid to make fun of itself, like that opening bit about the NBC mystery movie.
Oh, God, yeah.
If you go back and watch the episodes before that, whenever Flashlight comes on, they always would go, hey, it's the NBC mystery movie. So I think even they recognized they were writing that joke to death, so they kind of ended it there, that opening segment where he's giving him electroshock to make him stop making that joke.
Yeah, those running jokes throughout. I remember it's one of the early cinematic Titanics where Josh Weinstein makes a rock climbing reference. And I think it's Trace or Joel says, hey, we had that running joke after you left.
Right. They did one once where they signed a paper promising no more cop and donut jokes. And afterwards, they never made another cop donut joke again on the show, you know?
Uh-huh. But,
so I always liked that the show wasn't afraid to kind of, you know, make fun of itself in some ways too. That was, you know,
yeah, I mean,
I love good self-deprecating sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
I was just about to say, in the few episodes I've seen, I was always really upset that they never used the old Cold Fusion joke of colorful beakers of liquid smoke must mean there's science afoot. Which makes me miss Cold Fusion video reviews. I really wish that site hadn't gone down, but you know, that's just me and my nostalgia now. But yeah, please carry on, Lucky.
I was just gonna say, is there anybody have anything else to say about Teenagers from Outer Space?
The movie would have sucked probably more without the commentary. The scene where the lobsters attacking the search party is probably the highlight of the whole episode, other than the guy in the trunk. And the surprising of how violent it is, especially for 1959, the fact that you're seeing people vaporized into skeletons is pretty.
Well, it's always the same thing. They run, right? That they would. It was just the guy would start to run. It cut back to the Thor firing the gun, and then you cut back to him, and the skeleton would just drop on the ground. I mean, they never showed an actual transition or him. You know, it was a wonderful cheap special effect.
Yeah.
But I think just, you know, heightens the ridiculousness of this movie.
The other thing I forgot to mention as well is where they're trying to charge the ray gun, which apparently takes more power than it takes to like power the whole city to fuel this little ray gun so they can vaporize the lobster. And just the constant jokes they were making about Star Trek, I thought that was very funny.
Well, apparently that's a very famous canyon where they filmed those scenes, and it's appeared in a lot of cheesy movies.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it's the same one that's from Robot Monster, which Castle of Frankenstein referred to as one of the more familiar Hollywood caves.
Yeah, because it's shot off in the Bronson Canyon, which is in Griffith Park. So, yeah, it would be the same location as Robot Monster, the worst movie of all time.
Lackey being a Doctor Who fan, we know our caverns.
We know our caverns and quarries.
Quarries.
Yeah, quarries.
They did love a good quarry.
They did. All right. I think that was MST3K. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to go get liquored up, and I have to be nice and properly drunk to talk about Ultraman.
All right, Kristen, I am so excited that you've decided to do a podcast with me, but what are we going to do a podcast about? There's so many other movie podcasts. We got to do something original.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Disney movies. What about something like that?
That's just kid stuff. What do we want to do that for?
Did you know that The Avengers is a Disney movie? Or that Pulp Fiction is a Disney movie?
Pulp Fiction is not a Disney movie.
It's technically owned by Miramax, which is part of Disney.
We are still going to talk about the Disney animated movies, though, right?
I thought you said that was kid stuff.
Well, you know, I've got two kids. I got to be a good dad and stuff.
So be sure to subscribe to the Walt Sent Me podcast, where we discuss the various subsidiaries of the Walt Disney Studios, including the animated movies.
It's available on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts. And I swear, it's not kid stuff.
And we're back. Obviously, Stu joining us here in our, space station today, I guess is the right place. I lost track of what location we're in now. But
I'm calling it the satellite of mild indifference.
Okay. And we're obviously broadcasting from somewhere beneath the planet's surface. We have been joined today by Brian.
Actually, I've moved to Castle Hines, the less popular villain location from the Suffragettes.
In the first half of the show, we obviously discussed Mystery Science Theater 3000, Teenagers from Outer Space. We're now obviously moving on to my own selection of the evening, which is Ultraman. For those not familiar with Ultraman, he's probably one of the most key characters within Tokusatsu TV, really. I mean, he's up there with the likes of Kamen Rider, Super Sentai, and Metal Heroes. The Ultraman series is the second in the Ultra series, which started with Ultra Q, which we covered way back in episode 1. This series itself, it follows, again, a group of scientists that battle monsters. We have our hero who, after his plane was hit by Ultraman's pod as it came to Earth, became one. They became the symbiotic sort of being, so now he can actually turn himself into Ultraman when needed. Only for about a period of about 3 minutes, it has to be said, and basically each week he battles different monsters. This particular episode that we're covering tonight, the mysterious dinosaur base, is probably most noteworthy because the fact it recycles one of the old Godzilla suits. In fact, it's a combination of the two Godzilla suits. We've got the head, which is borrowed from the Densou Gojin costume, which was used in Invasion of the Astro Monsters and Emperor Horror of the Deep. But the body is the Amuzu Gojira suit, which the head of which was used in the first episode of Ultra Q. Here, the Godzilla suit is basically recycled and turned into a new monster known as Giras. Still within the suit, though, we have our longtime Godzilla actor who unfortunately had the bad side effect of having to wear the suit while they respray painted it. And he actually noted that this was probably worse than having to wear the suit. As I said, the actor who's in the suit is Hiruo Nakajima. Who did many of the original Godzilla movies, and he was joined here by Satoshi Bin Fura, who is in this episode is playing Ultraman. The episode itself, we have our mad scientist here who has been raising his pet Giras, which has had the side effect of causing the local fish population to explode, attracting people from the local area who decide that they're going to use the air to fish, but, you know, rather than using a rod or reel, they're going to just pump poison into the lake, which, of course, causes Giras to appear and go on a little mini rampage. Opening thoughts on this one, guys. I mean, are either of you sort of familiar with these sorts of things, or was this like an initial experience?
You know, in like the early 90s, we had Spectreman on syndication here in Chicago.
Yeah.
Which is like Ultraman, but not. But he's still a guy who grows into a giant and fights monsters, but this time monsters created by two monkeys.
Okay.
I seem to remember, and I think it could have been Ultraman or it could have been something else, but there used to be this, and I think maybe it might have even gotten over to your side of the pond. There used to be this show called Night Flight in America way back in the early days of cable, and I remember one thing that they would like that was kind of like a compilation clip show. I don't really know of any other modern ones to compare it to. Like the only other one I can really compare it to is like Nickelodeon's Turkey Television, where they would just basically show like this sort of almost like random sort of, you know, collection of like music videos and short films and things like that. And one of them was a project, and we're back to the Mad Movies MST3K type thing again, where people would basically redub episode of one of these shows, Japanese Spectreman or Ultraman type shows, with comedy dialogue. And I think it might have been Ultraman, but I could be completely wrong. But this is my third exposure to this format, proper exposure to this format, after the other two that I've watched for this podcast.
This is some crazy shit. Let me just say that.
I don't know what they're pumping into the water over in Japan.
Too much mercury in the sushi. I don't know. Something weird is happening in that land. But so much insanity. The fact that they basically dressed Godzilla in a Dilophosaurus frill. You remember the spitty dinosaur from Jurassic Park? And they had no way to keep it extended. So the frills, like the stems of the frills are on wires and kind of being held open. And it's kind of like flopping down. And it's the most ridiculous looking thing. And then during the battle, it's horrific. He rips the frill off. There's this like bloody neck length where his skin was ripped off. I'm like, this is his show.
Oh yeah. And he uses it as a Torah flag.
He uses it for a he uses it as a matador speech.
I just wanted to cut to Jira and say, hey, stop taunting me with my own flesh.
I mean, and yet after he defeats Juraz, he just lays it on top of his head so mournfully and respectfully. And I'm like,
farewell,
asshole.
Sweet friend.
Asshole.
This world's too good for you. We should get to the whole, and then the whole overly convoluted evil mad scientist thing, but can I just, okay, there's the science team that investigates these guys, and then there's the reporters who follow them around, I guess, and I assume they work for a tabloid or something.
Yeah.
I'm not serious. And the one, the photographer is Ultraman, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Okay. Did they have to pay extra for the package on their car to make it look like a giant monster?
It's basically Frankenstein's car,
isn't
it?
Sedan, I want the DX edition with the fangs and the fur and the eyeballs.
Yeah, it's basically Frankenstein's car from Death Race 3000.
I mean, that thing comes over the horizon like, what the fuck is that?
Subtlety.
How did I get one?
I think subtlety is probably one of those words that has no Japanese translation.
And no reference is made to this car. It just shows up.
Oh, no. No, it isn't.
Everyone accepts it. I assume it. Maybe it was when it first showed up in the series. Somebody made a reference. Probably not. But it's just, you know, it's just Japan has this ability to accept the crazy that I kind of wish the United States had outside of the political arena. Vote Trump.
Yeah.
When you watch this show, you can obviously see how it obviously influenced other films.
I mean, is it a monster themed tabloid they work for, and that's why they're driving a monster shaped car? I mean, that car is just, I'm obsessed with this car now. Why were they driving it? Why did it look that way? Why didn't anybody say anything? And then why did they go midnight fishing? I mean, that one guy was just going to sexually attack the writer, wasn't he? I assume that's what was going to happen.
I think so.
This is the fact that they're looking for information about the Loch Ness Monster, but rather than going
to
Scotland,
where Loch Ness
they go to ask the local scientists.
I wanted a scene with a Perry White style editor. We got to find out about Loch Ness Monster, but here's what I want you to do. Don't go to Scotland. Go talk to this professor. He knows everything about the Loch Ness Monster. Plus, we can't afford your travel vouchers anymore. But that's okay. Take my monster car. Here's the keys. It's got an eyeball on the keychain.
The monster car is really more of a J. Jonah Jameson type thing. Come on.
You have to love the fact, though, that the catch
him. I want pictures of Jira. Jira swinging from trees. Jira fighting crime.
I want pictures of Ultraman.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that the captain, he sends him out there to obviously find out what's happening with Juras, and they basically
he sends him out there to find the fish population has boomed.
Yeah,
and they said, you know, you don't know. Oh, have a vacation.
Oh. Yeah, have a special vacation.
Hey, we can play the pinball. Ding 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 ding.
Pinball wizard, it has to be a twist. And I just love the backstory. The backstory where they go and visit this elderly scientist who is this authority on the Loch Ness Monster, and he talks about this other scientist. There's this one line, and I swear to God, this will stick with me for the rest of my life. It will haunt me to my grave. If he went out there and was eaten by the Loch Ness Monster, that would have been the culmination of his lifelong dream. And I'm like, yes. Your lifelong dream is to be eaten by a dinosaur. Well, we can't fault you for ambition.
Hey, give me back my lighter. Breaks and hands it to him. Like, get out. That's like if they were in prison, he would be the head guy because he was totally dominant. Like, he's like, you're my bitch now. Break, snap it. Like, what the? So many odd choices here. And then the reveal.
Yes, because he's wearing a mask as well.
And he was that missing scientist who wasn't eaten by the Loch Ness Monster. But is that mean Jira was the Loch Ness Monster and he took him there and just transported him to Japan? Or he said kind of created him.
Yeah, because he's apparently spent the last 15 years feeding this monster.
So at some point he fakes his death with the Loch Ness Monster, moves to this small lake in Japan, wears a rubber mask over his face for the next 15 years to fake being bald, apparently, does this horrible mural of these dinosaurs that don't look anything like dinosaurs, genetically engineers this monster, and apparently feeds it too much, so much that the fish population booms.
I was going to ask that. How would the dinosaur...
But there's enough in there that the fish population booms, and that's what attracts, you know, and then runs lovingly to his monster, only for it to step on him.
Yeah.
Camera. But lives long enough to call it its name one more time and then drop dead. And what I loved, and this is kind of a cliche, but Jira and Ultraman have the samurai fight. I see this in every samurai or ninja movie. They're opposite sides. They stare at one another. Then they rush past each other, and one drops down. All of a sudden, Jira, they rush and strike each other, and then blood starts coming out of Jira's mouth, and he falls dead. That's in every samurai or ninja movie I've ever seen. And it's now in an Ultraman episode.
All that was missing was Toshiro Mifune.
And when they cut to the Jira's face, he's got like that metal capsule in his mouth. And a second later, that red paint starts pouring out of his mouth. It's like, wow.
So you're saying you didn't appreciate Ultraman demonstrating the Ultra Chop? I bet you're going to say next that when Hayata turns into Ultraman and he does a little Power Rangers... puts the capsule up in the end, just a little Power Rangers move that didn't get a thrill of excitement from yourself.
I want to apologize to Japan. I'm sorry about the hydrogen bombs. The radiation did something to you guys that we're not sure of, but I mean, I don't know where this crap is coming from. The imaginations over there, they're operating on a different level of crazy.
Yeah.
I just, my advice to you is never see Haozu. If you have never seen it, don't ever see it.
I've heard.
Yeah.
But that could be forgiven. That was a director asking his daughter to come up with a story, and she's coming all this crazy stuff. I mean, that's presumably these are grown men in business suits sitting around a writer's table thinking, "What now? Well, what if they do the Ultra Chop and, you know, he falls dead and he lays the frill mortally on his worthy opponent? And two guys in a rubber suit fighting, and shouldn't it be this insane?"
But, I mean, this is again Tsuburaya, who did many of the Godzilla effects in the original movies, and this was done for his production company. So when you look at it, it's very easy to compare to Godzilla. But unlike Godzilla, these fights don't take place in major cities. And this, again, would be a running theme within the Ultraman series, that they don't take place in within Tokyo.
Well, they probably only had one or two sets and couldn't afford to smash the...
They don't want to... I mean, he's all about, you know, preserving human life. He's not about the collateral damage that, like, Gamera seems to relish in.
Wow.
So it's the fact that we're having a lakeside fight, it kind of, you know, mixes things up a bit. I mean, obviously, like last episode, I subjected you to Pseudoman, or Japanese Spider-Man, as it's more commonly known. I mean, comparing the two, I mean, was this less or more insane than that experience?
I see, the thing is about the Japanese Spider-Man is that looking back at Japanese Spider-Man later, I did some research later, and I guess there are some, like, tropes of Japanese Spider-Man that just weren't present in that episode. Like, apparently, like, one of the tropes of the show is just, like, this insane transformation sequence, which never really happens in that episode. And I felt kind of, like, gypped a little bit, or I shouldn't say gypped, that's not a nice thing to say. I felt, you know, a little bit like disappointed, and this was just insanity from start to finish. I mean,
I really hope Leo Pardon makes it into the Ready Player One movie.
I have not read Ready Player One, so
no. Spider-Man's Japanese Spider-Man's giant robot Leo Pardon is a big part of the novel.
Oh God, yeah.
So I really hope Spielberg spends the money again to bring Leo Pardon in.
Would you recommend Ready Player One? Because I keep trying to find a review of it.
Not a great book, but it really plays to, like, 80s nostalgia. So if you're a child of the 80s like I am, I think you'll enjoy it. It's not a bad book. It's not great either. It's kind of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in cyberspace, if you will. I mean, there's...
Okay.
It's a decent read. Just get a cheap paperback somewhere.
I keep getting...
It's a little overhyped at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I love John Dice at the end, and everyone says, oh, if you like John Dice at the end, you should read Ready Player One and Rorschach texts, which I've read as well, which it seems to be lumped into that sort of...
My dad indie, got me a copy for my birthday. I read it. I resold it to Amazon, and then I started subscribing to Loot Crate, and my second Loot Crate, I opened it up, and they had sent me a paperback copy. So it's like, I can't get away from this book.
Nice.
But, you know, it's a decent read. If you let me put it this way, if you've ever spent serious time in a video arcade, buy this book.
We got any other Anything else that we want to bring up about Ultraman? I mean,
I just love some of the bizarre design choices in this one. I really liked the underground cavern lair where the door, where it's like a smooth polished metal door on one side and on the other side it's a rock. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, like, what's the aesthetic here? You're like trying to hide the door on the inside. It's like, why couldn't you just get it like a metal slab and have it both sides? Why did you put the rock on the eye? That probably a nitpick with me. Yeah, if you made the sea boil, if you've made the lake boil, you probably should keep throwing pods of poison to it.
I kind of feel like we missed an opportunity there with those two dumb teenagers who decided to jump the poison in to get the fish. That at some point they should have eaten the fish and then died and realized what idiots they were.
I also love the editing choice there where, like, 1 minute, they're, like, in the raft, and they cut to the sea boiling, and Jurassic is coming out, and then all of a sudden we cut them and they're swimming away. And it's like, scene
well, that's the same editing from Teenagers from Outer Space, you know?
Pretty much.
Run away, fire the gun, he's dead.
Yeah.
There's something there in that transition.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, would you feel compelled to watch any more? That's what I think the main thing is, because obviously they're still making these Ultraman series. They just, like with Power Rangers, they just keep changing the format. I mean, this one was obviously followed by Ultra 7, and as I said, they're still making them even now. I mean, we just, as of this year,
or
last year, it was there, had a new series come out.
Which came first, Ultraman or Jet Jaguar?
Ultraman came first. Jet Jaguar was created as part of a competition, and unfortunately, because Ultraman was so popular, the kids basically just gave like a rip-off version of Ultraman, and that became Jet Jaguar.
Nice. Well, I can watch another episode, but I think I'm going to need a long, long time before I can do that.
I don't know if I could binge-watch this shit. Brilliant. I thought this was just absolutely batshit insane brilliant. I didn't stop laughing for 25 straight minutes. There was always some fresh new insanity on the screen to crack me. And I couldn't take this in a movie, but in like a 25-minute long chunk, I could take it. I don't know. I could really, really enjoy it. I don't know if this is something that I certainly couldn't binge watch it. I don't know if this is something that I would really watch away from quote-unquote assignments like this.
I found myself riffing through most of this episode.
So did I.
I mean, it might be the kind of thing to watch once a week with friends drinking beer, you know?
Yeah. But
you get together for a movie night. Oh, and here's an episode. Here's the next episode of Ultraman. Let's,
Yeah.
I think it could become like a good group activity to watch one of these insane episodes and just, what the hell? You know, I know at some point I'm going to go and price having my Honda Civic turned into a monster car.
Yeah, definitely.
I kind of wish that we'd done a couple, because obviously the episode which follows it is the Rascal from Outer Space.
it was the Rascal from Outer Space, I don't think. It was the Ruffian from Outer Space.
Oh, it's
the Ruffian. I was looking at the space. It's like, what? It's the Ruffian from Outer Space. And after that, like, the scoundrel or cheat from Outer Space. It's like,
yeah.
I wanted it to be the Rascal because I wanted this morbidly obese monster on a little scooter to show up.
Well, it does feature a monster called Gango, who's she ticklish. Yeah, again, they're recycling another suit there because this time for the Gango suit, they just basically modified the Bemula suit. Which, obviously, if you don't follow occasion movies, will mean absolutely nothing to you at all.
This one, they made the guy wearing it stand around while they used lead paint.
Yep. I mean, the actor that they actually played the original Godzilla movies, I mean, the fact he was increasingly willing to do more and more risky things, like they put explosives around the neck of the costumes. They obviously spray painted him while he was in the suit, and he was like this concern that if he didn't go along with these things that he would be fired. And basically he played Godzilla for like a number of years, and then he got retired from playing Godzilla and went to work in the studio bowling alley. So he went from being Godzilla to a bowling alley manager while still working for the same company.
Well, it's nice they promoted him.
Japan, ladies and gentlemen, the country that brought you Hitalia.
But yeah, I mean, anything else we want to discuss about this one?
Just
is there a scientist in every episode?
I'm sorry?
Is there a mad scientist in every episode? I mean, I'm just...
I
have questions about the format now.
Yeah, the mad scientist is sort of like one of the go-to tropes, really. I mean, if you can't think of a reason for your monster to be there, then usually the mad scientist will make an appearance. Sometimes the monster stands up, or it'd be like some crook or something. Or like, I know in the next one, basically the monster starts off as like a rock that gets thrown into a lake and turns into this this monster. It's normally some random ass reason that the monster's there, but then again, you look at anything in the Tokusatsu genre, and normally it's some random ass reason for the monsters being there.
Definitely top three craziest things in this episode. Number three was the monster car. Number two, fishermen using poison to get their fish. And number one was the scientist revealing he was another scientist who absolutely nobody cared about. This is just, there was just a lot of theme insanity in this episode.
One of the things I'd noticed about this was that they later on in the episode, they start calling the mad scientist monster professor. What was the name of the villain in Japanese Spider-Man? Professor Monster. Coincidence? Probably.
It's always so hard to tell with the translations of these things.
Though. Some overworked college student was translating the Japanese stuff for all these episodes.
Because normally when you have like fan subs and stuff, you normally get some random ass things. I mean, there's one of the Shaw Brothers movies, I can't remember which one, that they have this scene where this guy's been beaten up, and the police inspector responds that this is the result of being a rascal.
This is ruffian behavior.
Yep.
I'm finished with this.
So I think that obviously brings us to the end of another edition of TV Good Sleep. Brian, obviously, we kind of screwed up at the start and didn't obviously introduce where you're from.
Professional podcast. I'm out of here. The hell with you people.
Obviously, if people do want to come and see more of your stuff, where's the best place to find you, Brian?
You can look up The Last Angry Geek on YouTube. You find all my shows there, or you can go to Channel Awesome, and I'm sure you can track me down on that site. But cool. I do a couple shows. I do comic book issues where I review recent comic books. I do You Know Who, where I review the new episodes of Doctor Who. And I have Geek Riffs, where I like to riff on educational shorts. I just did one called How to Say No, for people who never saw that episode of Different Strokes.
Fair enough. And are you on the Twitter or the Facebook?
I'm on Twitter at In Geek We Trust, and I have the Comic Book Issues Facebook page if you want to follow me there. But it's closed at the moment. We're going to be accepting new members early May.
Well, thank you again, Brian, for obviously coming on and discussing these two random-ass shows. Lucky, I mean, have you got anything happening in your side of the interweb?
I am taking a vacation from the Nightmare Gallery because I basically involved with a number of things that do not involve watching movies and writing reviews of them that have basically consumed my time and all my emotional energy, and I'm just basically taking a couple months off to recharge from that. So I don't think I'm gonna start doing that. The hiatus I'm planning for it to end. I'm hoping it will end at the end of April. It will probably be the beginning of June before, to be honest, though, before stuff starts showing up. I do have some guest podcasts lined up, I'm sure. I'm pretty sure I do. But as far as, like, actually writing stuff, I'm taking a break from that so I can focus on other things that have been devouring all my time.
That's cool. And more recently, you were also a guest on Lair of the Unwanted.
We discussed hackers. And, I discussed the hackers with Jason and Nolan. And I'd never seen that film. And that was quite the experience. And I got to share some of my memories of being adjacent to hacker and cracker culture in the early 90s. Also make a Zima joke. So
it's a great listen.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie, and it was, I thought, a very engaging conversation with Jason and Nolan. I always love getting together with those two. They're always a great time.
Yeah. I think The Layer of the Wanted is a great show. If you're not subscribed to it already, definitely do. I think they've only done one Duff episode, and that was the one I was on. Talk about Sledgehammer.
Yeah. So, I did a couple other ones. I don't know. I don't remember how recently they were, but I did do In Session Film and True Bromance. Those two where I discussed 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Nice.
So I've been again doing the podcast, making the podcast, the occasional guest podcast round. So I have been keeping my toe in the water.
Yeah. Cool. As for myself, I'm still happening over at From the Depths of DVD Hell, which you can find at fromthedepthsofdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. We still got the Buffy recaps happening over at our host site, Channel Superhero, which you can, as always, find at channelsuperhero.com. Not only are they hosting this show, but they've got all your weekly TV recaps for your superhero fix, as well as all your classic shows as well, including classic Batman, as well as the Buffy recaps that we've only got happening there at the moment. As well as that, we've got recaps for Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, iZombie. The Walking Dead is wrapping up its coverage there as well, with Rachel Chiro, which is absolutely great read as well. So plenty of stuff to check out there at channelsuperhero.com. If you obviously want to follow the show, we are on Twitter, which is at TV Good Sleep Bad. We are also on the Facebook, just type in TV Good Sleep Bad, and it will come up there. Thank you, as always. Thank you again to Vern for doing our opening, as well as Fuzzy Machete for providing the opening theme. TV is awesome. I keep forgetting to say thank you to them, so I'm going to say thank you now.
Yes, thank you, Vern, and thank you, Fuzzy Machete.
Yes. And again, thank you, Brian, for coming on this show. It's been an absolute blast having you on, and hopefully we can get you back soon.
Thank you.
What have we got lined up for the next episode?
Yes, before I sign off the show and completely forget, we haven't told people. For myself, we're going to take a break from doing Tokusatsu productions, because I think we've done two in a row now, and I don't think you'd really want to do a third one in a row.
I'm up for anything.
We still got plenty more of the Ultraman series to go, so I don't think this is the last we've seen.
No. I certainly hope not.
But as I said, we're going to do a different track. We're actually going to be looking at a BBC children's series called The Dark Season, which was written by Russell T. Davis of Doctor Who fame and Queer as Folk. And it also stars a young Kate Winslet. This is a show that, when I watched it as a kid, was probably one of the most traumatizing experiences, especially for a kids' TV show, and up there with the Outer Limits episode, The Boogeyman. So I'm very interested to see how this holds up from a nostalgia point, and how it plays for, obviously, yourself, like you've never seen.
Yeah, I heard about this not too long after the Doctor Who revival came out, when people were discussing Russell T. Davis's bona fides, and I'm also interested. I believe Jacqueline Pierce, who played Servlan on Blake Seven, I believe she's in this. I believe she plays the villain.
Yeah,
she plays. So I'm really, really looking forward to this. And it's not made its way over to American shows in any sort of official capacity. So this is something I've been looking to sink my teeth into for quite a while.
Cool. And what are you going to be bringing to the table there?
Well, I thought that since you were doing a pants-wettingly scary British TV, British kids show, I thought I'd give you I thought I'd pick a chunk of the what seems to have been the definitive late 70s, early 80s scare the pants off of British kids that wasn't Doctor Who. So I'm picking Adventure 4, number 4, of Sapphire and Steel, the original. I think this is informally titled The Man Without a Face. So creepy nursery rhymes, A Man Without a Face, and Joanna Lumley and David McCallum. So,
fun times.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Cool. Well, again, thank you everyone for listening to the show this evening. If you did enjoy liking what you've heard too, please let us know in the comment section below. If you listen on Podomatic or on iTunes, please leave us some feedback and let us what you know. And you can also, of course, let us know via either the Twitter or Facebook. But as always, thank you again to my co-host, Mr. Lackey.
Thank you, sir.
And this is Edward Jones, signing off another edition of TV Good, Sleep Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.